Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Cedar.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
Ever get the feeling you've been cheated?
It is Wednesday, July 27th, 2016. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the convention hall. Steps from the convention hall in Cleveland. No, we're not in Cleveland. Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. It's 2016. Can you guys hear me back in the studio?
Yep.
All right, that's good to hear. Sitting with me is the great Pete Dominic. Oh, he's from Sirius XM Radio. Bond? Oh, radio. Pete, welcome to the program.
Sam Cedar, it's great to be here, man. I've always been a huge fan of yours, and I'm a listener, and I just can't imagine how many cancellations you had till you got to me. I'm so flattered to be sitting down with you. Let's talk about who... When you're at these conventions, like, you book these big names, you're like, oh, and you prepare for so on. And right before we came over, they're like, Governor Malloy has canceled all of his appearances.
It started with Governor Dan Malloy was actually going to be in this slot. To be honest with you, I had a series of questions involving his ethical problems
in
Connecticut.
Go ahead and fire him at me, and I will take all of Governor Malloy's ethical issues.
I will do that right now.
Spin them. Go ahead.
Is it awkward to hire someone who is a lobbyist for Cigna, whose husband is an executive for Cigna, and whose father is an attorney for Cigna, and then put them in charge in deciding whether or not there's going to be this huge merger involving Cigna?
Now, Sam, you have to understand the pool of talent that we look to. And I mean,
is he from Michigan?
Is that the accent?
I don't know.
If you're going to tell me that all of these, all of our potential, you know, you could connect the dots with anybody the way that you just did. What we did is entirely ethical, and I would argue as normal. This is a really talented person. What's the person's name?
Wade, I think it's a lot. That's pretty good.
I
actually was going to bring a video camera because I assumed he would just get up and walk away.
Oh, really?
It's not something he wants to talk about. Apparently, they're bringing ethics charges. In fact, Bernie Sanders said that he should not be the DNC chair, co-chair, because of these ethics violations.
I know a lot of really progressive folks listen to the show, my show on Sirius XM, that live in Maryland, and they do not.
No, this is Connecticut. He's a.
What am I thinking? Oh, I didn't know that.
Oh, yeah, you're thinking of Martin O'Malley. No, no. Are you thinking of?
Well, no, the current governor of Maryland. Forget it. Anyway, wow, that's too bad to hear because I like that guy. I thought I did.
Well, I mean, he may be a nice guy, but he is probably responsible for a lot of
Connecticut.
Yeah, a lot of potential.
So much of the insurance industry. I mean,
exactly.
Joe Lieberman tanked single-handedly Medicare for All, or the public option, was it?
Well, his big thing actually was 55.
Right.
That wasn't a surprise. Buy into 50, Medicare at 55.
After 55, you could buy into Medicare, which is such an amazing idea and solution. And they had all the votes, but one senator, Joe Lieberman.
He used to support it until it became clear that the Affordable Care Act was going to salvage the insurance business. Because, of course, the problem with the insurance business is that as the American population gets older, and more people become a riskier part of the risk pool, the business model doesn't work. And so if you have people buy into Medicare, get off the private system, then if you're just insuring people from ages 20 to 45 or 55, you're going to be paying out a lot less.
I'm mad that President Obama didn't fight for an achieved single payer. And Bernie would have done that, and that's why I supported him. And Hillary's not going to do that. So, I mean, I'm not happy about this, and I'm not satisfied that we didn't get everything that we wanted.
Pete just walked out of the building, ladies and gentlemen. All right.
No, I just ate some nachos.
Let's talk about So you've been here, you've been talking to, you know, because it's Sirius XM, you got a producer, you got four mics, you've been talking to some of the best brains in the business, sitting down. Give me your sense and the sense that you're getting of the sense of how the convention's going so far. Let's start with last night. Bill Clinton gets up there, and I think, you know, you and I on your program talked about this yesterday. The key is make Hillary Clinton not seem like she's some type of
robot
and evil robot, really. I mean, and I don't know. What was your sense?
The people who think that she's evil and bad, obviously you're not going to change probably their mind necessarily. But the people, you know, who the Bernie supporters and others who might be on some kind of on the fence, they've known Hillary forever, they might. And I, from what I heard from very smart people, the main criticism of his speech was at the beginning when Bill Clinton talked about his basically his courtship or seduction of Hillary Clinton as a young girl in college. And I mean, I've heard that a lot. I don't know how to feel about it. What else is he supposed to? He had to talk about how he met her and how they started dating. I'm not sure how he could have done that any differently, but it certainly did make a lot of people feel uncomfortable given his history and certainly the accusations surrounding him, you know, in affairs with women.
You know, I'm of mixed feeling about that. I mean, because, unless concurrently, like as he was doing that with three other girls, and leaving that out at that time would have been a problem. But I think the idea was...
Weren't we all? I mean, always cast a large net and hope somebody... Sorry for the metaphor. But, I mean, it's... I don't know what... I think he had to do that. And I think that because he goes so off script, which is what people love about Trump, he's not all packaged, he might say something in a way that didn't...
There was a couple of things he said that I thought were sort of like... He's got a particular area of tone deafness that where he is stuck literally like 30 years ago. But before we get to that part, I think... The only criticism I heard of what he could have done was we say, like, she's been a better wife to me than I have been husband to her. And that's almost all you had to say at that point. And then everything is like, okay, he's acknowledged the...
That's a great way of putting it. Yeah, she's been a better partner in this relationship than I have been.
But it was fascinating because if you take, like, what Michelle Obama's speech or even Melania's speech...
Get it right, please.
Right. Mrs. Trump's speech.
You know what? I don't appreciate that.
About how he's a great guy. When I first met him, he had this to say. Like, you know, right? It's the exact same model, except we've just never heard it from the perspective of a guy, A, as the first guy, and B, a guy who was also sort of was president. So that's sort of...
You know, when we talk about anybody who's had as long a career in public service as she has had, we tend to, certainly in media, radio and television, we tend to minimize it to a few sentences, and in this case about Hillary Clinton, of insignificance or failure. The truth is, she was the First Lady of Arkansas, First Lady of the United States, Senator, and Secretary of State. Every day, certainly when she was a Senator and Secretary of State, she did stuff.
Yep.
She did stuff, and he did a good job of pointing out not only that, but more specifically, the stuff she did before she got into politics, especially with kids. It's hard for me to believe at this point that she doesn't really sincerely care about young people, about children, those in her family and those that she's worked and advocated for. And the other thing I always like to tell people is I'm a big advocate for women and girls and those issues, and I've talked to and worked with a whole lot of
Hold on for 1 second. Hey, guys, what's that music? Oh, sorry, go ahead.
I've worked with a whole lot of organizations, women's groups, that say what she did for women and girls as Secretary of State, not only in the U.S., but all over the country, underdeveloped nations, she'll never get the credit. But she really advocated strongly for women and girls, which we know the solution to poverty is to educate women. And she did a lot for that.
And because I am a huge wet blanket, I also should point out that he neglected to say stuff like board of director of Walmart and, and of course, I mean, because this is, I mean, let's be honest here, folks. I mean, and know that we understand this as we're talking about this. This is just an advertisement, right? And so we're judging this based on how well you advertise the good part. And in this sort of advertisement, that is the convention, you don't have to put that disclaimer at the end, like may cause diarrhea, may cause social anxiety, that type of thing.
Don't you think that the criticism of politicians' ambition is a little bit, first of all, it's hacky and it's kind of unoriginal at this point, but aren't we all, haven't you, Sam, been ambitious in your career and climbed a ladder and networked and taken certain gigs? And
not enough, but no, but I'm not criticizing her ambition. I have no problem.
I'm just saying, of course she did a bunch of different things to get ahead, and so do other politicians.
Oh,
and that's what they're supposed to, granted, they're supposed to be public servants, but if you are a small-town mayor, I mean, look at Tim Kaine. He was the mayor of Richmond. He was the governor of Richmond. He's a senator from Richmond. He was also, graduated with degrees from prestigious colleges and went as a missionary to Honduras and learned Spanish. He did a lot of things, and so did Barack Obama, that add up to making you qualified for being president. And I think that's what you're supposed to do, aren't you?
Yeah, I think the idea of the ambition is it's a lie. I mean, it's a lie insofar as, like, of course, anybody who you hear says that somebody else is ambitious through media or any other channels except for the guy sitting next to you at the bar is clearly ambitious themselves, or they wouldn't be in a position to actually even express that opinion to you. And so that's absurd. But, his job was to get out there and basically say, like, two things I think it was to do. One was to say, like, she's a human being. Here's a sense of her life trajectory. He left out some of the parts, but it's not, I don't think he embellished. In other words, I don't think he made up the, stuff. I think he just sort of omitted some stuff that...
You drop her in anywhere in the world, you drop her into a problem, she's going to make it better. Well, she didn't necessarily make Libya better. I mean, there's plenty of things that you can knock about what he said about her, but it's the former president of the United States talking about his wife. Obviously, that's the speech that he's going to give, but I'm excited about what's to come tonight and tomorrow night. I mean,
I hope people walk out on Bloomberg. That's my hope.
Oh, really?
Why? I think it's appalling that Michael Bloomberg is speaking at this convention. Stop and frisk. His general economic policies. If he gets up and he talks exclusively about guns, okay, but
aren't
I can't help but think
principled on that, because the bottom line is his endorsement of Hillary Clinton matters.
To whom?
Okay, maybe it doesn't matter to anybody.
No, but honestly,
I think that every endorsement has got to matter for better or for worse. He's a former Republican. He's a businessman. He's a billionaire. He's Jewish. I don't know. I think his endorsement does matter.
Give me the demographic of the person who's going to go, you know what? If Bloomberg's...
I was not prepared for that question. And so I don't have an answer.
Honestly, like
New York.
We already had a Jewish New York guy endorser, right?
Cedar. But here's the thing. If people walk out...
What Jewish New Yorkers are going to be swayed by Michael Bloomberg?
My friend Barry Klein. Lives in the Upper West Side, 273 89th Street.
Somebody head over to Barry Klein's place right now and see
wife,
if and stick a microphone
Jewish,
in it.
Who is a really anti-Semitic Trump supporter, by the way. This is unbelievable. But no, if people walk out the way Sam Cedar hopes, selfishly, because of principles, that'll be the story tomorrow.
That's right.
And that's
right.
Probably bad. And I think anything that's bad for
Hillary is
probably good for
That's
Trump.
Why I think it's such a mistake that the guy is talking. Like, it is completely tone deaf, and I'm not convinced there's a constituency out there. Like, maybe, honestly, like, I think maybe Tag Romney might, after hearing Bloomberg, decide to vote for Hillary Clinton. But beyond Tag
also
Romney.
Pig Palin, and, I think.
No,
could be
the Palins are not going
to
do it.
Tig.
Tag Romney.
I just wanted to say
and,
Tig.
Whatever the other name, Biff Romney.
When
like two or three of the Romney sons, I bet, are gonna look at this and go, well, if Bloomberg's for her, maybe we should swing that way. But I don't know if there's anybody else.
I'm not an everyday listener to the Majority Report, but do you often reference Tag Romney? Because if you don't, nice poll. And how many listeners of yours today thought we were going to mention Tig and Tag during today's
Tag
broadcast?
Romney comes up probably, I don't know, 3-4 times a week.
I'm stealing that, for sure. I'm going to be referencing Tag Romney quite a bit more. I think the Romneys are going to vote for Hillary Clinton.
Yeah, I think so. If Bloomberg delivers enough of an endorsement. Otherwise, it probably would have been
Tim
Bill
Kaine
Weld.
Is speaking. I think he's going to have a far more of an influence, I think, than anybody's expecting him. I think it's a, I actually think he's a really good pick. One thing that nobody's talked about with Tim Kaine, by the way, and I want to mention this on your show, I'm a big public education guy. I like Diane Ravitch. She's my disciple.
Fantastic.
I've read all of her books. She wrote a,
is she your disciple?
Blog, huh?
She's your disciple?
She's mine. She's a disciple of mine. I don't speak English great, Sam. I don't know if you've heard my show.
Reference
I
you
never,
that.
Listen, I'm sorry for who canceled, and you want to apologize to your audience that they're having to endure that I just said I was Christ. I'm Christ-like. Tim Kaine's wife is the Secretary of Education there in Virginia.
She's very intelligent.
Education.
Yes.
And there's so many Democrats that want to privatize education.
Yep.
I think that's the solution. There aren't too many teachers and education experts that want to do that. But I'm really excited about that one thing, and I haven't heard anybody talk about that. I don't think Tim Kaine's going to be able to go home at night if Hillary Clinton is trying to be a, quote, reformer.
You know, I'll tell you something. I spoke to, and you should actually interview this guy, Peter Montgomery. He is the vice chair of the AFT. And the beauty about getting the vice chair of the AFT as opposed to the president of the AFT or of the
Randy
NEA.
Weingarten.
Yeah, Weingarten or... I can't remember her name. She's the head of the other teachers union.
She's a disciple of
mine. Lily Garcia, something. I can't.
Yeah, oh, yeah. Lily
okay.
Eskelin.
Yes. Those two have all their talking points. But apparently the vice chair, not so much.
What'd you get?
Well, no, he was more frank. And he said, look, Hillary Clinton is going to be significantly better than Barack Obama on education. He was from Illinois. He knew Arne Duncan... obviously prior to him becoming the Secretary of Education. And I've got that interview. We're going to play that either for members or whatnot.
Oh, I got to hear it. It's my strongest criticism of Obama at this point, because I've pretty much given him a pass on almost everything. I think he's the best president of our lifetime in many ways, given the situation. But on education, like all the criticisms, like I understand how he had to do certain things to get elected, to get votes. I don't blame him that Gitmo didn't get closed. I don't blame him that cap and trade wasn't passed. He didn't have to appoint Arne Duncan, his good friend. And Arne Duncan has been terrible for education. He has no idea what he's doing. He's a business guy, business background. I don't get that appointment, and I don't get him standing by those policies. And
that's one of the fundamental problems I think Obama has, is that he's still, you know, and, you know, this word neoliberal gets thrown around, I think, too much than it should. But it is very much a function of believing that market-based solutions are effective. I mean, that's where, you know, a big part of the Affordable Care Act, obviously,
because,
is that...
Because, you know, in public education, we should have schools and children competing against each other.
It's absurd.
Because we want winners and losers in English class. It's so wrong, and no other country does what we do with education. And the direction that we're going in, that is a train... I think it's really hard to
I feel like
around.
the pendulum is switching.
I
feel like the pendulum is switching back
you
on
do?
That. Yeah, I do. I do. I mean, there's been such pushback on the race to the top, as it were, and I feel like the teachers' unions are getting smarter about this stuff.
Yeah, that's
I think
true.
I was talking to this guy about Friedrich, because the you know basically the two things I like to mention 3 days a week. Are Tag Romney or Scalia being dead. And
Scalia died?
Scalia died.
This is amazing news.
But the Friedrichs case would have decimated public sector unions, and I almost got Montgomery to say, like, he was happy that Scalia died. He wouldn't go that far, but he sort of smiled when I said
it. I don't know if I want to say this in the air, but I had a weird vision of Donald Trump dying, and I felt horrible about it because I know so many people have thought that about politicians that I've supported. But, I mean, like, I don't think that Donald Trump is going to win at all. But I think that what he has done to the country, and you know, it's been real bad. It's been real bad how much he's been able to simplify things and get support for those things. I get sick by it, and I get really affected. By the way, do you think, like, have you had relationships ruined over friends, people you know, supporting Trump? We live in Rockland County in New York, which is really conservative.
Uh-huh.
We have three Trump signs in our neighborhood. One of the families, which we know pretty well, they watch our dog. They're really great, awesome people. They put a Trump sign, and we're like, what? we had no idea. And now I don't even want to have them.
It's like
over.
Finding
Am
out.
I,
like you have a
I can't get past it, Sam.
I got to tell you, A, I maintain an extremely narrow social circle. So I rarely have that type of problem. And B, I live in Brooklyn, so it's not a problem. Oh, but my guest is here. Oh, great.
Christine.
Oh, great, great. Yes.
Oh, please bump me for her. She was just on my show.
I didn't bump you. We did 20 minutes, man. This is great. I appreciate it. Okay.
Now, because Christine Pelosi is coming up. She's real smart.
Is there a way that people can listen to your show without having to bump?
No one should listen.
I guess you basically have to follow Kevin Cruz on Twitter to find out everything he said.
Love, shout out for Kevin Cruz. You can get a temporary subscription to SiriusXM, and hopefully then you'll or buy a new car, get your free one.
Is there a coupon code I can give people?
We'll try to get one out. Insight is the channel 121, every day 9 to noon. Sam, thanks.
Very
for having
smart
me.
Stuff.
I love you.
I really do enjoy
you
it.
And think you're one of the best in the business. Thank you.
Thank you too, buddy. Appreciate it. All right, folks. Joining me now is Christine Pelosi. She is she just texted me, and she, of course, is the daughter of the minority leader. Hold on one second. Apparently, okay. Yeah, I will. Okay. Hi, come on. We are live. You should know. Right into that mic. Christine Pelosi, of course, you are here with Campaign Boot Camp 2.0, which is basic training for candidates, staffers, volunteers, and nonprofits. It's a 7-step guide to winning. Is this your book?
This is my book. I wrote it 4 years ago. I've been taking it around the country. I've been to 41 states. And 4 foreign countries actually doing candidate boot camps, civil service, democracy boot camps for people who want to run for office or who are running nonprofits or volunteers thinking of taking the next leap. We did a little training yesterday morning with my Democracy Partners team, and it was a lot of fun.
I've run into a lot of Bernie Sanders supporters who are talking about running. I mean, have you seen that? Have you seen any uptick in that in terms of like local races?
Well, actually, a woman who was at our Democracy Partners training yesterday, we talked afterwards, and she told me that she's running for a local board of education coming out of the Bernie campaign. So
we had a
great talk. We had a good time, and she, she's very passionate and very smart. And she said, "I'm going to read your book. I'm going to do these things. I'm going to get ready." So it's exciting. I think there are a lot of people who. Usually the presidential campaign brings out people who want to run for delegate. And then after they've run for delegate and they become surrogates, they say, now I want to start running for local office. So I hope that Clinton, Obama, Sanders people will take the next step. And
yeah, I
run.
Just wonder if there are campaigns that in some way, sorry, folks, I get somebody. If there are campaigns that tend to, provide a bump in people getting involved in local races.
Well, that is the goal. I chair the California Democratic Party Women's Caucus. So at our caucus meeting in June, I reminded people that 8 years ago when Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton had run a very, very strong race all the way to the convention, right after the election, probably 3,000 people in California knew that there was the deadline to run for Assembly District Committee member delegate, but it does get you to the state convention, and you had to file by December. But we found some people from the campaigns who were interested in running, and we went to some of the elected officials who usually run slates in those districts and said, make room. And one of those people who had made room is now our chair of our state board of equalization, Fiona Ma, and a woman she had made room for, Susan Pfeiffer, was an Obama delegate who's not a Hillary delegate. So when they make room, it really does make a difference, because then the new people come. So what I challenged them in California was, we have 80 assembly districts. If 2 new people ran in each one, that'd be 160 new party leaders. Wow. Who could come out of the campaign. So I think,
So this is a big benefit of
this.
Primaries. I mean,
absolutely.
I never really contemplated that, but I imagine 2012 there's a dip because you just don't bring as many people into the primary process, and you don't bring as many people into the process.
No, I think primaries are really important. I think that having the competition strengthens the Democratic Party. The key is to make sure that the party is open to everyone, and that the party leaders open up their caucuses or open up the opportunities and trainings to everybody, including people who, being brand new to the process, don't necessarily know how things work.
Right.
They might ask what seemed to be a bizarre question or a novice question, but everybody had that question the first time.
Right.
They encountered that particular Picayune experience, whether it was what are the filing deadlines to run for local office, or what the heck is a superdelegate and why is that person trumping my vote?
Now you're a superdelegate,
yes,
and you have been advocating to diminish the power of superdelegates. So tell us what you've been advocating for specifically, and where we are at this point, because this is, to me, I mean, I don't know, maybe I haven't been listening in the wrong places, but this seems to me to be a fairly underreported story.
I, 8 years ago, was part of what activists called the Pelosi Club. My mother, Nancy Pelosi, and I both said we're going to give our ballots to the candidate of choice, but our convention vote was going to go to the pledged delegate winner, and we thought that we, even though we had a superpower of basically being equivalent to 10,000 voters, that we should use our powers as a force for good and support the democratic process. My mom ran for national chair of the DNC 30 years ago and lost, in part because she wanted to abolish superdelegates. Plot twist, she got elected to Congress and became the first woman Speaker of the House in history.
So it worked out.
So it worked out better for the country and for her. But 7 years ago, I went with my baby daughter in my hands and I testified to the commission that they set up the last time, and I said, you have to do something about the caucuses. Nobody wants to see me and this little baby at a caucus for 7 hours. In fact, they might vote my way just to get me out of there. You have to do something about the conventions, because they're scheduled for during the week rather on weekends when more working people can come. You have to do something about the calendar so that we rotate around more, so that early states can have influence, like California, which has been early and has been late. And you have to reduce superdelegates to no more than 5% and bind us all to the national winner. I do think you need to have people stay neutral in the primary, in terms of being the state chair, the state vice chair, the national committee officers. You know, there's a certain group of people who really should be neutral until the primaries are over.
Mm-hmm.
But once they're over, on the first ballot, they ought to go to the national pledge delegate winner. Now, where we are now is that I wrote a resolution with some Bernie supporters in California. I support Hillary, they're for Bernie, but we wrote a resolution together that passed unanimously that mentioned these four elements. And at the Rules Committee, there was a unity resolution that passed overwhelmingly to create a unity commission and to bind DNC members to our states and keep the elected public officers, president, vice president, Congress, Senate, governor, at having an unpledged vote. What happens next is that we appoint people to get on that commission. The commission meets, but just as Tim Kaine's commission, who said abolish all superdelegates,
right,
met and abolished that, said they were going to abolish them and then it didn't make it into the rules, we also have to get into the rules. So I've told some of the Bernie people I worked with, get on the Unity Commission, try to get on the DNC Rules Committee. You have to see this through so that it's in the call to the 2020 convention.
Okay, so we're down the process, and in terms of numbers, it basically works out to about two-thirds abolishing the special powers of two-thirds of superdelegates, and the remaining one-third are at least elected representatives who theoretically, right, like, I didn't like how you voted with your superdelegate. I mean, it's one more element, I guess. I mean, so there's some more accountability there.
Well, there is accountability. I would say this. I think you should bind everybody, and I would
right.
still push for that, even though the Unity Commission went to a certain place. And this is why. Some of these senators were elected 5.5 years ago. Some of the governors were elected 3.5
right.
years ago. Every single House member was elected 18 months ago before now. So why are we... that's where the voters felt then. It doesn't necessarily mean that they're in touch with how the voters feel now.
Right.
And it actually antagonizes them vis-a-vis their constituents, because they have the ability to trump their constituents at any time. And by just saying, well,
I mean, I would imagine some
of
the representatives would appreciate not having to make the choice
Correct.
Because they don't want to offend some percentage of their constituency versus offending who could be the next nominee. And so they don't want to be caught in that bind. In other words, I think it's a polite way of saying, look, politicians would much rather have a much more narrow set of choices to make, because every choice they make in some way cost them votes.
Well, look, if you, that's just like how it played out. California, May 1st. That's when we had district-level caucuses for Hillary and Bernie, both on the same day, so you could only go to one. And there were people who didn't like that because they said, well, I have some friends running as Bernie delegates and some people running as Hillary delegates. And I said, well, respectfully, you have to choose. I actually sent some people away from our Hillary one up the street right. to where the Bernie folks were meeting, because I said, you know, if you're a Bernie voter and you like both of them, you know, you should probably go up the street to the Bernie one, because that person probably needs your vote more, because the right. person you like in my caucus is going to win, because they like the woman who had been the long time, the woman Susan Pfeiffer that I told you about before, that was the Obama person that became the Hillary person. But this Sanders supporter liked her. So if you're the member of Congress, you had hundreds of people in Nancy Pelosi's district caucusing for Bernie, hundreds of people in Nancy Pelosi's district caucusing for Hillary. We want all of those, 100% of those people voting for Nancy.
Right.
So it's a lot easier if you're Nancy to say, hey, look, I'm for whoever ends up winning my district.
Well, it's fascinating stuff. The book is Campaign Bootcamp 2.0. Someday we should talk about your documentary on George W. Bush. Was that?
We'll talk. Anyway, good to see you. Thank you
nice
for having
you
me.
Thanks,
take care.
Thanks so much for coming by.
All right. Bye-bye. So, superdelegates, watch what happens.
Yeah.
It's all going to be very interesting. They're pushing me out, but okay. to be continued.
Yes. Okay. So there you have it, folks. I mean, there has been some reform in terms of now it is a real pleasure coming over to sit down with me is Dan Rather. It's a pretty exciting opportunity for me to talk to someone. I don't know if you recall, but I sat on a panel with you on MSNBC a couple years ago, and it was one of the highlights of my career. So I really do appreciate your sitting down with us.
No, happy to do it.
So, Dan Rather, you've been watching conventions, obviously, for a long time.
This is my 31st.
31st convention. And give me a sense of where this fits. I mean, both sort of in terms of what's happening with the convention, but also where the country is now.
Well, first of all, we haven't finished with the Democratic convention, so we need to wait till the end of both conventions before we make a judgment. I would say this is among the more interesting presidential election years. As presidential election cycles go, we're talking about the whole cycle of the president. One of the more interesting, and obviously because of Donald Trump, who's something new on the political scene. Yes, he has some bloodline politically to George Wallace, maybe William Jennings Bryan way back in the 19th century. But we never had anyone quite like Donald Trump, a business tycoon who became a reality show star, megastar, and celebrity, who's never held any public office before, never mind running before. He's never right. held even an appointive office, who has mastered the new media. If he's elected president, he'll be the first social media president in the same way that John Kennedy was really the first television president, Franklin Roosevelt was the first radio president. In terms of the conventions, that again, Trump overshadows both conventions, because you basically had, it's partly because the Republicans were first, that he set the agenda.
Right.
Now, the Democrats come back. In a way, they have an advantage being second. And by the way, you know how that goes. The incumbent party always comes second at the conventions. But the Democrats now, they can look at the Republican convention, the phenomenon of Donald Trump, whether you like him or not, and say to themselves, A, to what do we have to respond? And secondly, what didn't the Republicans and Trump do that we need to do? An example would be, I was somewhat surprised. Donald Trump, in his acceptance speech, never mentioned the troops abroad. He never mentioned our fighting men and women. This is unusual, but particularly for a Republican candidate for president, not to do so. I don't mean this critically. I'm prepared to be critical of other things, but just analyzing. He never mentioned the troops overseas. Now, the Democrats have an opportunity to say, in effect, without actually saying it, but signal, you know what? Donald Trump ignored our troops overseas, and General Allen, who speaks tonight, will address that. But does Hillary Clinton mention that or not?
Right.
That's the sort of thing. In the history of conventions, I don't think either of these conventions will go down as one of the greats, if you will, or most remembered. If either one is, it's more likely to be the Trump convention because of the phenomenon of Trump. But I say that keeping in mind that it sort of gets glossed over. This is the first and only presidential nominating convention that's ever nominated a woman to run as a party. So if you're looking at somebody writing the history books of conventions 50 or 100 years from now, they may very well mention this Democratic convention because it nominated a woman.
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, I wonder if, in your opinion, has there been a wholesale change in the rules, like the laws of gravity,
right,
in how it deals with these? Because Donald Trump has, in many respects, bucked all of the conventional wisdom in terms of who's supposed to win a nomination, right? I mean, there's been a lot of academic research about the question of, you can't, I mean, theoretically, right? This is why a lot of academics missed the Donald Trump phenomena. You can't win the election, the primary, without the support of the party apparatus. And he did so.
Exactly.
And the traditional, you can't win without some type of very strong ground game. I mean, this is a guy who went on like one campaign stop per week, which is, he didn't do any of the retail politicking that we've come to, I guess, believe and assume is necessary.
Well, absolutely true. And we're about to find out whether in the modern era, can anyone win the presidency, win the election without what the conventional wisdom said were the fundamentals of organizing at the precinct level, carrying right at the state level, using big data to pinpoint what voters are for you and against you. Trump has none of that. Now, so far he succeeded by turning conventional, let's call it the standard political book, he's thrown out the window. We'll see going forward whether he continues to do that. But there are more important aspects of his throwing the book out the window. Before Trump, no candidate for the presidency could have survived going on television and mocking a person in the audience, a reporter, who had physical and nerve-centered health difficulties. This crossed a line. Republican presidents of the past, Lincoln, Theodore Roosevelt, Dwight Eisenhower, Ronald Reagan, they wouldn't think of doing such a thing. My point is the line of what was considered to be civility and decency that no candidate could cross. Before Trump, any candidate for the presidency who was seen mocking someone in that form would have been out immediately.
In a moment, yeah.
But with Trump, not only survived it, but he thrived after it. Second, there's a long list of these, but to criticize John McCain for his service to his country, whatever you think of John McCain,
right,
in prison 6.5 years, North Vietnam prison, and then ridiculing McCain for that, particularly being a person, as Trump was, who's never served in the U.S. military. Again, no candidate before Trump could have survived that.
Well, is this indicative of Trump, or is it indicative of what has happened to the base of the Republican Party? Or rather than what's been happened to, where they've been nurtured, how they've been sort of massaged? I mean, are we looking, is Trump the phenomena, or are we just at a tipping point of what has happened with the Republican Party? And this is the final question.
That's an insightful question. I'm not sure is the straight answer. But I lean a bit to the tipping point. I think for so long the Republican Party has played directly to people's fears, resentment, anger, with, yes, a mix of racial prejudice into it. They seem to succeed for a long time, but now it's coming to fruition the other way. But beyond that question, and having said this insightfully, the more important question is what's happened to the country, not just the Republican Party. Are we or are we not a people who will accept mocking in public someone who has a health weakness? Are we as a country, as a people, as a society at the point where you can dismiss and even criticize and try to humiliate somebody who spent 6.5 years in a prison company? That's the big question that's going to get decided in November.
Indeed. Dan Rather, a real pleasure for me. I've got to take a selfie because
of course
of us. Thank you very much. And I'm actually doing that on air.
Here,
so,
we come to this microphone.
Oh, well, I don't know. Yeah. Thank you very much.
Thank
I really
you
appreciate
much.
Your stopping
Enjoy
by.
Being with you.
Thank you.
You.
Have a great rest of the convention.
Good luck. Godspeed. Okay.
All right, folks. Dan Rather, a living legend. I mean, I think that's I think that's about as accurate of a description as I can give of our last guest. Very excited to have the opportunity to talk to him. And it's actually Pete Dominic who set him up. So Pete Dominic coming through big time. And of course it was big time. All right, so I was anticipating one more guest. Don't know what the situation is there, but maybe we'll head into the fun half. I know that we have some sound clips. I wanted to, I don't know when this rant will come out, but I don't know. Guys in the studio, did I mention yesterday this whole Uber thing?
Yes, you did mention it.
It's even worse. Like So I'm taking this, taking cabs for the most part. I'm mixing it up. I'm half and half. Usually, I'm exclusively public transportation, but the place I'm living is not terribly close, and walking even like 6 to 8 blocks with my pack full of crap that I'm walking around with.
You're living there? You're going to live there now? Come back. Please come back after the convention.
I think you misinterpreted what I said. No, I'm not. My pack. I've got a huge like gear pack that I'm coming to the convention. So I've been taking cabs more often than I normally would. And the cabs, when you take a cab to the Wells Fargo Convention Center, they don't let you get as close as if you were taking an Uber, like literally by almost a half a mile. So you're walking through these empty parking lots, dodging Uber cars coming in. It is 98 degrees out. I am wearing a sport coat, the one that I borrowed from Jimmy Dore, and sweating profusely. And it's because, I just find that so problematic about the Uber thing, but I guess I've already spoken about that. All right, well, let's take a break. We'll head into the fun half of the show. We've got clips of the moment where Bernie Sanders' brother Larry voted for him during the roll call yesterday. As you know, at the end of the roll call, Bernie Sanders, who wanted the count to be there. And I think I mentioned, did I mention yesterday that I spoke to John Nichols, who made it really clear, and we'll play this. I'm not sure exactly what members will get all the stuff I recorded. But John Nichols made it really clear why Bernie Sanders wanted that vote. And apparently it has to do with a picture of Eugene Debs, that Bernie Sanders has in his office. Also, we have a clip of Bernie talking to some of his supporters. I mean, there's some people who are very upset in this convention hall, and part of it, you know, we spoke to Dave Sparks yesterday, I think it was his name, and you know, there a lot of it is there is a sense that the establishment folks look down upon the Sanders folks, and frankly, you know, this is. I think this is one of the first times that you've had people feel like they had a candidate. And because a lot of these people have been here, and frankly, a lot of people who listen to radio, you know, radio has always been the poor stepchild on the left, much more so than TV. Radio on the right is considered far more powerful. Even the way they set up Radio Row here, we are nowhere near. We're completely sequestered from the television people. In Cleveland, I've been told that they put everybody together. And so people go do TV, and then they go and invariably do radio because they see the value of hitting both audiences. Now, radio, your average listener, or I should say radio, because of how inexpensive and ubiquitous it is, tends to have a broader demographic. People not as wealthy have the opportunity to listen to radio traditionally, and they're listening to it at work. They're listening to it en route to their business. I mean, I think there's a lot of that is caught up in that. And, you know, Bernie Sanders, I don't know how many times he was on national television or even cable television before this year, but listeners of this program and listeners of Tom Hartman, I mean, he's been on Tom Hartman's show for over a decade, more, on a weekly basis, for an entire hour. On Fridays, for years and years. So it's interesting to see this divide, you know, become a little bit more explicit and become increasingly personalized for people. And I don't think it's a new thing. I think it's just that people feel like they've had a champion. And I think sometimes that's hard to let go, but I'm very encouraged at the number of people that I have met just walking around here who are saying, you know, Bernie inspired me to run for X, Y, or Z. But, all right, we're going to take a break and, head into the fun half. It's possible I may have, Paul Booth, who is a longtime labor activist, and join us. He's the executive assistant to the president of AFSCME now. I don't know. He was supposed to be here, but again, guests are a little bit tricky. But all right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll be in the fun half. Don't forget, folks, support this program by becoming a member today at jointhemajorityreport.com. We'll be right back. Sitting up